Someone's got the keys in here.
Yeah, it's going well.
Will you tell me later number of the people going upstairs for dinner?
Yes, of course.
Okay.
Thank you. Do I have your number still?
I'll give it to you. 0433.
0433.
2484.
Perfect.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you.
right. Well, we might get started. So welcome to our first in-person branch event for 2021. Hi, everyone. Welcome to our first in-person branch event for 2021, lurching towards normalcy, insurrection, inauguration, impeachment. So I'm Gráinne O'Connell, and I'm standing in for our President John Goodlad tonight. He's just taking a break to focus on some family commitments. And we've had a really great start to the year. So last week we had our first webinar, which we co-hosted with AAA in Victoria. And that was on the situation in Myanmar. And then we had a young professionals trivia night also on the weekend. So apparently that was really well attended. So congratulations. I don't know if there are any committee, YPN committee members tonight. No. Anyway, good job to those guys. So just in starting, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which we meet tonight, the Whadjuk people of the Noongar Nation, and just acknowledge and respect the continuing culture and the contribution they make to the life of this city and this region. In the audience tonight, I'd like to recognise our immediate past president, Dr. Sue Boyd. We also have AAA vice president and fellow of the Institute, Professor Samina Yasmin, here this evening. And also former US Consul General Robin McClellan, thank you for coming, along with our other esteemed guests and members. We really appreciate you being here. So before I introduce our guest speaker for tonight, we would like to just get a show of hands of who will be coming for dinner. We've had a change of the arrangement with the club, so will be an a la carte menu tonight. So Molly, we'll just take a show of hands if you could let us know. And I'll be coming to you. Yeah. Perfect. Thanks, Molly. So while we're adjourned for the summer break, I'm sure we were all really gripped by the events and the developments in the US, in particular the storming of the Capitol building on January 6th. Here to discuss the transition from Trump to Biden and what it will mean for Australia, we, in a moment, will be welcoming Professor Gordon Flake to speak for us. Professor Flake is a well-known and widely respected voice in the international affairs community. CEO and founder of the Perth US Asia Centre, he spent 25 years in US foreign policy roles before arriving in Perth 7 years ago to establish the centre. He is a leading authority on issues of US politics, foreign policy, and strategic developments in the Indo-Pacific. His work has been published in many leading media publications, including the Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, and the New York Times, as well as featuring widely in Australian media. He is governor of the American Chamber of Commerce in Australia and serves on the board of the United States Studies Centre at the University of Sydney. So in introducing, we'd like to welcome Professor Gordon Flake to speak on lurching towards normalcy, insurrection, inauguration, impeachment. Thank you.
Well, thank you. It's good to be back. I tried to convince Ash that you would be tired of my voice by now, but the topic itself remains perennially fascinating, if not alarming, in that process. Let me also acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land in which we meet, the Whadjuk people of the Noongar Nation. I would note that this week I saw a news report that they have translated the Bruce Lee movie Enter the Dragon into the Noongar language, which I think is wonderful. I think you may recall from previous remarks I made, I was born and raised on the Navajo Nation, a remote Native American tribe in the northeastern corner of Arizona. And about a decade ago, they translated Star Wars into Navajo, and it's this big hit. So we're working on it. It's a good thing. Before I get to three I's, and the bulk of my remarks tonight, insurrection, inauguration, impeachment, I thought I'd give a little bit of context about something fundamental that has changed. And I'll give you a little bit of a personal anecdote about this as well. In 1998, I was in Washington, D.C. I was hosting a North Korean delegation the vice foreign minister at the time, Kim Gae-kwon. We had been running this program for a couple of years, and we'd run out of money, so I no longer had the fancy stretch limousines. I had my minivan, you know, a Ford Windstar minivan. I had to scrape the kids' Cheerios out of the back seat, and I put the vice foreign minister, and I took him out to Great Falls Park. Those of you who've been to Washington, D.C. will know the Potomac River comes down. Beautiful park. And we had Kentucky Fried Chicken, KFC, in a big bucket. And I was talking to him. I said, you know what? The name of Korea, particularly the name used by North Korea, Joseon. Joseon literally means the land of the morning calm. Those of you who have been to Korea might know it's called the land of the morning calm. I said, that's really a bad name for your country. And he says, what do you mean? I said, well, I live in Washington, D.C., and I'm exactly, you know, 12 hours different time zone from you. And every single morning, I wake up, and there's no calm in the morning because you have done something. You've tested a missile, done a nuclear test, some provocation. And the news is always that I have to react to first thing in the morning. So my mornings are never calm in dealing with your country. And he laughed, and I laughed. And the very next morning, North Korea tested a missile over Japan. Yeah, which proved my point. It's the closest I've ever come to being prophetic, right? The thing I want to tie that little story to is Twitter. I have spent the better part of the last 4 years absolutely dreading mornings because I knew that I was going to wake up to some outrage, some statement, some tweet that was going to dominate my day. You know, media calls, discussions, taxi drivers, people serving camera. Did you see what Donald Trump said? You know, and all of a sudden, since the 8th of January, it has been so wonderfully quiet. You know, yeah, we do not have this stream of consciousness, you know, knowledge of exactly what some person is thinking at exactly some point of the day. And it is remarkably normal. Hence the title, Lurching Towards Normalcy. We're not there yet, but it really has been a breath of fresh air. So let me address the three I's. Insurrection. Inauguration and impeachment, and then I'll talk a little bit about where we're going in the future and how it impacts Australia-U.S. relations. As you all know, the U.S. election system is such that after the election is over, each state individually, you know, certifies the election results, and then on the 6th of January, those certified election results are received by the vice president, counted by the Congress, and in a rather, you know, symbolic, formulaic effort, recognized as being true and official, and that's part of the process leading up to the inauguration. It did not go as normal this year. Now, let me give a little bit of context to this, too. The evening of the 6th of January here in Perth, I was having dinner with two close friends, and I was more optimistic than I had been in a long time, because for those of you who are following the results, the deep south state of Georgia had, in a historic turn, along with my home state of Arizona, voted for Joe Biden, right? It was a remarkable historic development, largely on the grounds of some remarkable grassroots mobilization, voter registration, etc. And yet, because every state in the U.S. has a slightly different system in terms of their own electoral processes, Georgia is one of the few that has you have to get past 50%, you know, and if you don't get more than 50% of the vote, you have to have a special runoff by election. So in that case, Georgia, because of, you know, one senator who was up for re-election and another one that was a special election that had to be at the same time, had this rare confluence of two senators running at the same time, both of them having a special by-election, and that election was also on the 5th of January, right? So big, big deal. So I went to bed the night of the 6th of January here really in a good mood because there was a really good news story that people hadn't focused on, and that is that the great citizens of Georgia, in against expectations, had returned, you know, had not returned to office, had elected Raphael Warnock, you know, an African-American preacher who was, you know, preaches at the same church that Martin Luther King, you know, taught at, to the Senate of the, and it was just a remarkable development. And it looked like that evening that John Ossoff, a relatively young, in his 30s, Jewish American, was going to be the first ever Jewish American senator from Georgia, just like Raphael Warnock was the first ever African American senator from Georgia. But the results weren't quite clear when we went to bed. So I woke up on the 7th here, the 6th in the U.S., quite excited, as my normal habit is, which is a very bad habit, reached for my phone, turned on Twitter to see what has been happening in the world, right? And I was shocked. And to put this in context, you know, I spent 25 years in Washington, D.C., and Americans ascribe a level of holy writ, of sacredness to our democratic processes, much more so than you do in Australia. I mean, I spent last week in Canberra. Parliament House is nice, but there isn't that same sense of reverence. Maybe it's the natural irreverence of Australian society writ large. But the Capitol, even in the 25 years I spent in Washington, D.C., was sacred ground, right? It is the birthplace of democracy, the temple of democracy, and the way Americans think about it. And so whenever I entered, and all the years, and the thousands of trips into the Capitol, to go inside that building, it was a reverent place. And so for me that morning to turn on the TV and to see a violent insurrection, you know, attacking the Capitol, attacking the, you know, that temple of democracy, if you will, and the resultant loss of life, bloodshed in that Capitol, it shocked me to my core. It was a horrible day. I was out of sorts for days after that, right? Because it was a really serious thing. It was something that again, I don't think I ever imagined, right? I knew there was going to be a rally. What I didn't imagine was the whole series of events that would lead up to the violence and the attack on the Capitol. And it's all premised on what people now are calling the big lie, right? It was all premised on the argument that the election was stolen, right? And it was fomented by the President of the United States. It was fomented by allies of the President of the United States. It was fomented by certain members of the United States Senate who were at that moment meeting to formally certify, you know, on a national level, those ballots that had been certified in the state level. And remember, during the interim, there had been 84 different court cases, most of them in states that had Republican judges, many of them in states that had Trump-appointed judges, all of which had been knocked back, right? You know, and so every state, again, Republican states, had certified the election. It was over. It was a formulaic thing. But the people believed and were encouraged by the president that they had to fight. And there was a lot of conspiracies going on. And it was horrible. It was tragic. It just shocked me to my core. Now, having said that, as dark as that day was, for those of you who watched it, 2 weeks later, in that same venue on the Capitol, there was an inauguration that took place. And my wife and I stayed up till 2 a.m. in the morning to watch the inauguration. And I'm seeing Robin nodding her head because I needed some closure, right? I needed that end of the process to watch that. And for those of you who watched or saw clips of it, it was, again, a reminder of the things that the U.S. does well, right? The pageantry, right? The speeches, the soaring music, the poetry by Amanda Gorman, that young African-American poet that just brought me to tears, right? It's interesting to me that two-week period of time was a remarkable shift in terms of sentiments. And again, you saw the worst of America, and then in 2 weeks later, you saw the best of the America in terms of that process. But that wasn't it. That was just kind of the start of the process. It was not a normal inauguration. It wasn't an normal transition. And part of that was something that led to very quickly after that, the third I that I want to talk about, which is impeachment. The decision on the part of the House of Representatives to move precipitously before the president was inaugurated to say, look, the act of the former president of the United States, Donald Trump, to incite violence, to urge his supporters to go to the Capitol, you know, is tantamount to treason, to tantamount to encouraging insurrection. So he was impeached for the first time ever for the second time. So again, a quick clarification here. Impeachment is an act done by the House. Whether or not that impeachment is held to be a conviction worthy of removal from office is a separate step altogether. So Trump was not unimpeached by the failure of the Senate to convict him. He just was not removed from office. And remember, there was a push to do this impeachment trial before the inauguration, because according to the Constitution, impeachment is a remedy to remove someone from office. And at the time, you won't be surprised to know that then Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said, we don't have enough time, this is too rushed, we'll have to do the trial after, you know, the president's gone from office. And then immediately after the inauguration, when they started the impeachment proceedings, they said, well, we can't do him after because he's no longer in office. And so we can't do it before, can't do it after. They went ahead with it. It was a necessary process in terms of the national psyche. You can imagine there were a lot of people who were deeply frustrated that they did not call witnesses, that it didn't go on long. It became pretty clear that, you know, after the initial shock had worn off and a number of Republican senators had you know, expressed their dismay, if not their outright anger with Donald Trump, they then went home and met with their very radicalized bases and realized that there was danger in that approach. And so they quickly came back into line. And so in the end, you know, the vote was, I think, you know, 57 to 43, you know, in favor of impeachment. It requires a two-third majority. So Donald Trump was not, you know, convicted in that process and went on his merry way, albeit without his Twitter in terms of that process, right? So that's kind of where we stand right now. There were several political considerations in play for the Senate. Number one was they have a very big agenda in front of them. They need to get the president's, you know, President Biden's cabinet confirmed and in place. They needed to deal with COVID. They needed to deal with an economic, you know, stimulus package, you know, an economic relief package, a COVID relief package. And all of that was at risk of being held up in the process. And they made the political judgment that the point was made that there would be ongoing efforts to kind of do a special 9/11 type inquiry into this process, that no matter what they said, they weren't going to convince enough Republican senators to convict, so we might as well move on in the process. And that's kind of where we are today. Yeah? So let me move on with a couple of other things that I think are worth touching. And I thought I'd reserve the bulk of our time just for questions, because the number of issues that we're dealing with are so diverse, it might be useful just to have a conversation of issues that you're concerned about, confused about, angry about, happy about, as long as you'd like to address those. But let's talk about COVID. On the day of the insurrection, 313,000 Americans contracted COVID. One day, right? You may have seen this week, there has been a rather somber commemoration in the United States because we've passed the 500,000 mark. 500,000 Americans have died because of COVID. You know, and it was just shocking for a developed country, a country that should have been among the world leaders in a response to this, to have so criminally been negligent in terms of how they responded to it. The good news is this, and again, there's a strange correlation. I think that the 313,000 thing wasn't the 6th, it was on the 8th. It was on Friday the 8th. That from that day on, that's the day that Donald Trump was banned from Twitter, right? You know, the number of cases has dropped like a rock, precipitously. So as of today, there were 64,000 new cases contracted. Now, in an Australian context, you will all remember just, you know, 3 weeks ago where one case shut us down for 2 weeks, right? So today, the United States had 64,000. It's horrific, it's unimaginable. But you put that in the context of where we were before at 313,000 in a single day, you get some sense for the progress being made just by stopping the shedding of misinformation, just by consistent messaging and leadership on that front. There's also a relatively good news story on vaccines. Again, a year ago today, every news story you turned on to told you that vaccines were going to be years away from development. And as of today, 44.5 million Americans have already received at least one dose of the vaccine. So that process is rolling out with record speed, and I anticipate it will only accelerate from here on out. And it has to, just because, you know, there is no other strategy, there is no other option at this point in terms of how that process is going. But you will not be surprised to know that while a Biden administration has come in a world of hurt, economic issues, unemployment issues, you know, U.S. reputational issues, foreign policy issues, whatever you want. There's just so much work to be done. But their priorities have to be and have been COVID. And the recognition is unless that has got under control, there is no path to economic recovery. Unless that's under control, there is no path to U.S. legitimacy globally. Unless that's under control, there is no governance mechanism. So that really has been their priority, and it's rightly so. Again, there's a lot of us, I mean, basically the world over, that would like to see a lot of things from the Biden administration, but I think we all have to recognize that prioritization. Now, let me talk about one other thing, which I think is useful. Because I spent 25 years in Washington, I am uniquely attuned to political appointments and positioning, because that was the game in Washington, D.C., right? Unlike Australia, and unlike many countries in the world, the U.S., there's a remarkable revolving door in Washington, D.C. It's often considered a negative thing, people going from business into government and then out into think tanks or back into government stuff. I, because I was a participant in that community for a long time, tend to have a much more favorable assessment of that process, because the way it has worked in the U.S. traditionally is that if you were someone who leaned conservative or you were a Republican, you know, you would work, you'd start out young in your career, you could work in government for a while. If you were going through a civil service career, you would just work your way up in government and you would be nonpartisan largely. You'd be working essentially, you know, and by requirement, you were nonpartisan. You obviously had your own personal beliefs, but that was the approach. Outside of that group were a lot of people who were more political, right? Who would spend, you know, 4 years or 8 years, depending on how long your party was outside of government, working on ideas, writing papers, making recommendations, developing it, working in a very large think tank community in Washington, D.C. Now, to put this in context, the U.S. federal bureaucracy, not including the military, is about 3.3 million people. And so that's more than the entire population of WA, just federal government employees, right? So think about that for a second. How does an incoming president, now Joe Biden, how does he impart upon that large bureaucracy his plans, his policies, his will? And the answer is through political appointees, people who are appointed to come in there based on their, you know, their relationships, their views, that they have views and policies that are simpatico with that president. Now, among those, again, there's different ways of counting it, but if you take out career ambassadors and stuff like that, and you look at political appointed positions that are relatively senior, assistant secretary level or above within the government, those are people who require confirmation by the Senate. There's about 550 of those, right? 550 people that require, there's more, there's 1,000, but if you go to lots of other ones, the core assistant secretary above that require that level. Now, I wrote an article 4 years ago, right around March, right, that said, follow the people. You've heard the famous line, follow the money, right? Well, if you really wanted to know where the Trump administration is going, I said, look at these people. And one of the issues was that 4 years ago, the vast majority, especially in my space, the foreign policy space, of political appointees, you know, or people who would be political appointees on the Republican side of politics, had recognized the threat that Trump was and signed on to these Never Trump letters, right? They said, we don't want any part of this. So the Republican foreign policy establishment, if you will, said, uh-uh, I don't want any part of this. And because of that disloyalty, they were never even considered, right? And so again, I'll be really blunt. You know, Trump did not start with the Republican A team or B team. He kind of started with the C team in terms of people who were ideologically in sync with him. A Republican, had not criticized him personally or signed on to Never Trump letters, and then were thereby eligible for appointment. And then on top of that, there was a general disdain for the role of government. So I think at the peak, if I recall correctly, at the peak, only 66% of those political appointed positions were ever filled. Most of them were just left vacant, right? Most of them were, you know, they didn't have the authority to make decisions anyway. They're all made kind of pell-mell out of the White House anyway. They never filled them, right, in terms of that process. By contrast, on his very first day in office, President Joe Biden went into the White House and he pulled up this great big computer screen with thousands and thousands of little faces on it, Zoom call, and he conducted a via Zoom mass swearing in of 1,000 political appointees on the first day. 1,000. Now, these were not Senate confirmed. They're not the senior ones. They're the ones that they could just do it Yeah, other than that. So obviously a lot more to go. The problem on the senior level has actually been more difficult just because we didn't have a normal transition. The Senate wasn't functioning properly. You had impeachment and other issues on the board. And so actually the pace of cabinet confirmations has actually been slower in Biden, under Biden, you know, than it was under Trump, just because the Senate is slowing down that process, right? And we've seen today, you know, some gradual progress, but it's going to take a while, given a narrowly divided 50-50 Senate with the vice president as a tiebreaker, to get moving on that front. And this is a bit of a challenge. The good news is this, is that for everybody who despaired, oh, what happened to the America that we knew? What an insane last 4 years this was. What are the crazy things they're doing? The way the U.S. system works is those people didn't go away. Yeah, you know, most people stayed there in Washington. They were there. And as I was indicating, they were ready to come back in and ready to run the show. And so what you've seen is just basically the mass application of just core nonpartisan, not nonpartisan, core competence, non-high-profile, non-sensationalist, right? So if you look across the entire Biden cabinet that has been nominated and now many of them Senate confirmed, other than John Kerry, there's probably not a name that most people in the public would have known, right? You know, so Bill Burns is now just confirmed today, you know, former State Department guy, just universally respected just for sheer competence, right? Tony Blinken, the Secretary of State, again, outside of diplomatic circles, he's not a publicly known name. Yeah. Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, didn't require Senate confirmation, but again, not publicly known, not a showboat, not flashy, just sheer competence, respected on both sides of the aisle. Again, the only possible exception to that is John Kerry, just because former presidential candidate, former senator, former Secretary of State, and he has been appointed as the climate czar. Again, I don't think that's Senate confirmed, the climate czar. It's just a White House appointment. But that gives you a sense for where these issues are going. So now, let me talk about my basic view. My basic view is it's a lot easier to tear things down than it is to build things. You know, there is a lot of hard work to be done. I watched an interview yesterday with Pete Buttigieg, you know, Mayor Pete, the former mayor of South Bend, Indiana. He was just talking about, you know, the real challenges of taking over a department that has been largely gutted over 4 years, where senior people have left, where projects have been undone. Robin can let you know how much of a toll the last 4 years took upon the senior levels of the State Department. You know, the most senior people basically said, yeah, I don't want part of this. This doesn't represent me and my values. And so there has been a loss of a remarkable level of leadership in that front. It's going to take some time to rebuild. Trust with the allies is going to take some time to rebuild. But having said that, you know, when you ever find yourself in a hole, the first thing you do is stop digging. And I think if you look at the last, you know, almost 4 weeks now, the Biden administration has done a lot better than stop digging. They're proactively kind of building the stairway back out of the hole. But it's a tough task to go ahead. Now, let me look at this from an Australian perspective. You may be aware about 3 weeks ago, we hosted the leader of the opposition for a public speech, Anthony Albanese, and he was very liberal with his criticism of the current government in Australia for being so close to Trump and of the view that you know, that was dangerous. You know? And I, in the course of 3 or 4 days after that, fielded many media calls where the first question was, do you agree with Anthony Albanese, right? And I have institutional responsibilities, right, as representative of the Perth U.S. Asia Center. And so, particularly when it comes to Australian politics, I had to approach this not politically, but analytically. And my analysis shared in every occasion was this, is that Australia probably did a better job of managing the Trump era than any other U.S. ally in the world. And it was a hard task. Now, you just have to think back 4 years ago, right around the election time, when all of a sudden, you know, you had an Australian government widely anticipating a Hillary Clinton win, having to pivot on a dime to a Trump victory. And then the interesting thing for me, and this was a real concern I had in November, December 2016, was that you had, again, Prime Minister Turnbull, our Foreign Minister Julie Bishop, doing their best to calibrate to a Trump win, you know, in terms of how they messaged, how they said that. And in the meantime, the Australian public view of the U.S. was just dropping like a rock, right? And my worry was that the gap between our government's messaging for the sake of maintaining the alliance relationship and where the public opinion was would grow so large that it would be tempting for Labor just to drive a truck right through that because, you know, it's just too tempting, right? So you may recall shortly thereafter there was this initial phone call between our Prime Minister, then Malcolm Turnbull, and Donald Trump, and it was about the you know, taking in refugees from, I think, from Manus Island. And it went really badly, and it devolved into a shouting match, and that leaked. To me, that phone call was a godsend. What a wonderful thing, right? Because one, it allowed Australia to look tough standing up to Donald Trump. It allowed it to be an Australian issue, so it allowed Labor and the Liberal National Party to recalibrate and come together. And then the relationship with the U.S. didn't become a partisan issue for us. And then over the course of the next 4 years, it was tough. I mean, just ask Canada, ask NATO, ask South Korea, ask Mexico. It was a real tough time, to manage that relationship with the United States. Now, Australia had some inherent advantages, right? One, we have a trade deficit with the United States, right? That means we're not target on our head, right? Two, we spend more than 2% of our GDP on defense. So we are in the gold star characteristic. And we've got really skilled diplomats, plus Greg Norman, right? So those help, right? And we leveraged everything to manage that relationship very well in terms of the process. So my view, and this is what I've espoused in the weeks since the insurrection, inauguration, impeachment, is that Australia, of course, will recalibrate. There's been a lot of media focus on climate change, which I understand why the focus is there. But the U.S.-Australia relationship is much greater than any one person, a la Donald Trump, and it's certainly much larger than any one issue, like climate change. And if you look at the full spectrum of issues where we can work together now, it is so much wider than it was just 2 months ago. And to put that in context, I would note this, that we as Australians are the ultimate joiners, right? We love international organizations, we love international meetings, we love international treaties. We are multilateralists at the core. It's hard to find an international agreement in this region, at least, that Australia hasn't been involved with in the very beginning and an enthusiastic advocate for in terms of that process, right? Part of that is because our national mantra of having a rules-based order is born of the fact that we recognize that we've got only 25 million people in a region full of very big powers, and we don't want to live in a world where might makes right. We want to live in a world where you have the rule of law or you have a rules-based order of some way or the other, hence we join. Well, during the last 4 years, the Trump administration was hostile to almost every imaginable form of multilateralism, international organizations. They pulled out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Then Australia came along together with Japan and miraculously resurrected that organization or that agreement. It's one of those great ironies is that I think in the international trade space, the most significant development of the last 4 years was not the signing of the Regional Cooperative Economic Partnership Agreement, which is lowest, it's a good thing, it's good, but it's lowest common denominator, everybody get together and agree on the minimum we can. It was Japan and Australia together saying, ooh, despite the fact that the U.S. has pulled out, we want to hold the line on a higher quality Trans-Pacific Partnership, and we're going to call it the Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, CPTPP. The problem is both Japan and Australia, as treaty allies of the United States, did not want to offend the orange guy, and so we couldn't celebrate this great accomplishment. So it's like, yay, TPP, but we never did anything or said anything about it, but that's there. We did that, right? And now if you think about it, the U.S. is going to be so proactive at trying to prove once again that it can be a good citizen in the region. And they are going to be eager to show that. And they're going to look to Australia to be their partner and their advocate in the full spectrum of multilateral organizations, institutions, standards, and norms and agreements. And so, yes, there will be concern about climate change. I don't think that there's anyone in the U.S. right now that thinks climate change, our number one problem is those Aussies. That's not going to be the issue, right? The potential for Australia to be a partner is much greater. So I have this strange feeling, which I have not had for quite a while, of optimism. You know, tough times, but there are these green shoots that should give us, you know, a sense that there's you know, a positive direction that is going. And if nothing else, we can look back with this tremendous sigh of relief at January 6th and just think what could have been. We can look back at the election in November 6th and think what could have been. We could look at the results of the Georgia election on the 5th of January and say what could have been. And in the end, I think there is obviously a hard road ahead, but we are certainly in a far better position than we have been for a long time. So hopefully that gives you a sense for my view as to what's going on right now, and it's sparked some questions that you might have that will carry us through a good conversation. So.
So we'll just ask if you could introduce yourself as you ask the questions. We might start with Sue.
Gordon, thank you very much indeed for that.
Introduce
myself. Sue Boyd, immediate past president. Sorry. Thank you very much for that. You always have this wonderful enthusiasm and the knowledge of an insider, and you know, sharing all those views. And I must say, what you're saying rings true. We can see that. My question I have is now, what about China? Because one of the things about dealing with China is this question of how far we actually want to distance ourselves from the United States, given that the United States has got this quite serious disagreement going on with China. Now, in a way, your United States is China's number one enemy and so on and so forth. That's a relationship we're all going to have to manage. And for Australia to be very closely identified with the United States in our discussions and our way to find a way through the relationship with China might not be the best thing. So how do we manage that? Because you are our major ally, you're our treaty partner. There's no doubt that we have a naturally good relationship with the United States, and one doesn't want to undermine that. But in the wider spectrum of the challenges facing us right now, how do we handle that?
Thank you. So I spent, as I mentioned earlier, last week in Canberra, and I was just a week after the Sue Boyd book tour. So I was in Sue's wake in Canberra. And so whenever everybody hears Western Australia, it's like, oh, yeah, you're from Sue Boyd State, which is good. It's a good thing to be. Look, many of you may know there is a scholar at the Australian National University, a former defense official named Hugh White. He's been a friend and a debating partner of mine, you know, probably for 25 years, right? And Hugh has long had this premise that China's a rising power and that Australia needs to accommodate the rise of China. And it's a process, and it needs to be prepared to distance itself from the United States. One of my greatest gripes against Donald Trump is that he gave oxygen to Hugh White. I mean, if you get to the end of 2015, beginning of 2016, right, he had completely lost all credibility within the national security circles in Canberra. You know, that thesis was old and gone. And all of a sudden, Donald Trump comes along and just proves every point he was making and just makes that a very relevant debate again. However, my view is this. If you look at the last 4 years, Donald Trump, far from being tough on China, you know, was like on so many other issues, all performance art, no strategy, no substance, right? So big talking, but he didn't do anything, right? Yeah, I mean, and all the issues where there was sincere, growing international coalition to try to get China to do some fundamental economic reforms that were basically unfair treatment of other countries around the world, all that coordinated pressure was just squandered, you know, for a handful of soybeans so that Trump could say he had a tough negotiation. You know, he didn't put, you know, he basically gave China a green light on Hong Kong. He gave them a green light on the Uyghurs. You know, when there were sanctions against ZTE, one of the Chinese tech companies, Donald Trump personally intervened to back off on those issues, right? And in the end, his deals, his very transactional, mercantilist deals with China on ag issues were easy for China. Just buy more beans from the U.S. instead of from Australia. So it didn't help us at all, right? Now, you contrast that to this last 12 months, right? Australia has been dealing with this challenge for a long time. And the question is where you stand. My view is that the Chinese very quickly had written off the prospect of serious progression of relations with the U.S. And so they began to focus their attention on Europe, on Germany, on Japan, on that process. But remarkably, ineffective given the shift that was taking place in China. And I'll highlight a couple of things. In October of last year, they had a foreign ministers meeting in Tokyo called the Quad. The Quad is a grouping of Japan, the United States, Australia, and India. And previously, it had been very sensitive to the Japanese, very sensitive to the Indians. But over the last several years, it had been very sensitive to the Australians. We pulled out in 2007, right? So sensitive to us in that process, right? But in the last 4 years, all four of those countries are enthusiastic about the Quad. In fact, I've said for the last year that you can measure how important something is to Australia by the willingness of our cabinet ministers to do quarantine for 2 weeks when they come back from a meeting, right? So Linda Reynolds, our defense minister, and Maurice Payne, the foreign minister, made the decision to go to Washington, D.C. for the Osmond ministerial meetings in July, came back and did 2 weeks of quarantine. In October, Maurice Payne made the decision to go to Tokyo just weeks before the U.S. election. Now, to be clear, Mike Pompeo is not somebody who is generally held in high regard in diplomatic circles. I don't think that Sue Boyd has ever used the term swagger, didn't use it in your book about diplomatic swagger, and define that as swagger as humility, as Mike Pompeo did. And yet, the Japanese hosted a meeting. Australia and India foreign ministers rushed to Tokyo to embrace the Quad and embrace Mike Pompeo weeks before the election. Why would they do that? And I argue that had far more to do with Chinese overreach than U.S. outreach. It wasn't an applaud of what the U.S. was doing. It was an open expression of concern about what China was doing. Now, let's get back to Australia in particular, right? We have been the victim of some very aggressive attacks from China economically. You know, we had my colleague Jeff Wilson, who's our director of research. You know, ostensibly, the Perth U.S. Asia Center, when we were established 7 years ago, we made a decision that we weren't going to be a China center, because when we were set up, we surveyed the landscape, and everywhere in Australia was China, 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 China. And we thought, well, look, nobody's paying due attention to Japan, to Korea, to ASEAN, Vietnam, Indonesia, India. We're going to be Indo-Pacific. Of course, we don't ignore China, but we don't have a China mission as a center, and we haven't, right? The last year, my colleague Jeff, who is our director of research, has loved to exalt the fact that he gets more media mentions than me. Right? His bubble is bigger than my bubble in our media assessment, right? And our number one topic has been China. And that's just because he's a trade specialist, and there's been a trade war where China's been attacking sector by sector, whether it's crayfish or wine or barley, and it's gone down this list with very punitive actions in terms of that process. Now, the interesting thing about that is there was long a belief that, again, there's this debate in Canberra. If we had just not been so close to the U.S., which, again, these were not based on being close to the U.S., or if we had just not called for a special inquiry on the origins of COVID, and then the Chinese came out with this list of 14 complaints, which is basically, these are all our problems with you, please stop being Australia, and then we'll be okay. As long as you're not Australia, we'll be okay with you, that argument, right? But in the end, the interesting thing was, there was a presumption that this was a classic case, to use a Chinese proverb, of killing the chicken to scare the monkeys, right? So in other words, it wasn't so much about Australia, it's about teaching these uppity Aussies, don't you dare stand up to China, because we want to make sure that the Singaporeans and the Malays and the Thais and the Philippines and the Indians and everybody else realize that there's a price to be paid, and you, Australia, are going to cop that price. Now again, we in Australia don't necessarily realize this, but we're not the only ones, right? Canada has copped the real price as a result of their decision to detain Princess Meng, from Huawei, right? India has had some real issues on the border. The Philippines copped the real price after their decision to take China to the International Tribunal on the South China Seas. South Korea's decision to deploy a THAAD, Theater High Altitude Aerial Defense Battle, led to economic consequences to them. But in Australia, it was the most sustained and systematic over the course of the last 6 months, until this year. So what happened this year? The Biden administration comes in. On day one, Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, sends out a message about his concern of Chinese unfair economic treatment of an ally, Australia. On day two, Tony Blinken has a similar statement. Just last week, there was a coordinated statement of 87 countries concerned about hostage diplomacy, what China has done with Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor, and that's a coordinated effort. And what you've seen then is this remarkable shift from China's approach 6 months ago to now, and I would argue they're doing it because they recognize that in contrast to the Trump era, when it was all about Trump, you're dealing with a coordinated country that actually cares about allies, right? Whereas Trump didn't understand alliances or care about alliances, and you had the risk that if you're China, that the framing challenge for Australia-US relations was going to be how badly China was treating Australia. Now, do I think now that just because that's come along there's going to be no problems? No. But we're not alone in that, right? This is a systemic thing. It's global in terms of that process. But you won't be surprised to know that I believe that Australia is far better off in close coordination with the United States and other like-minded partners, including the Quad, because I've seen little evidence to suggest that the other direction of trying to placate the Chinese, particularly at this time, would lead to a better outcome. So I'm sorry, that's a very long answer, but I thought I would just weave a few other things into that process.
Good evening, Mike Brennan. And my question is this. You'd have to say that the Republican Party has taken an absolute hammering over the past 4 years. They lost the House, they lost the Senate, they've lost the presidency. So in the lead-up to the midterm elections, what do you have any predictions about what's going to happen with the Republican Party?
My favourite tweet, meme, whatever it is, that came out after the election was, my goodness, in 4 years, Donald Trump has cost Republicans the White House, the Senate, and the House. He did make America great again. but look, at a more serious level, I may sound like I'm this waving, screaming, liberal, anti-Trump, I'm liberal as in progressive Democrat here, but I was originally a Republican. I registered as a Republican voter all the way up until 2010 when I changed my registration to independent. Now, as an Aussie citizen, I've got 2 weeks to figure out whether I lean Labor or lean Liberal, and I can't figure it out yet, right? So that's not where I am politically in terms of that process. I am deeply concerned about the ongoing trajectory of the Republican Party. And there's two things that happened that I think were really, really telling, right? There was an effort in the Republican Party to censure Liz Cheney. Liz Cheney, as you may know, is the daughter of former Vice President Dick Cheney. She's the now the minority whip, so she's the third in command among the House Republican leadership. And she voted for impeachment. And so they had a vote among the Senate to censure her, to deprive her of her leadership position because she dared to say something bad about Donald Trump and to vote for impeachment. And they did something quite unique. They allowed for a secret ballot. And in a secret ballot, she won 2-1. Right? Yeah. And in contrast, there have been numerous other occasions where you don't have a secret ballot, including the impeachment vote itself, where you didn't have the exact same results, right? It's because basically what it is the Republicans today, anybody who's got half a brain, is terrified of their base. They're terrified of Donald Trump. I don't think they should be, but look, I think many of you saw a year ago in January when my cousin, former U.S. Senator Jeff Flake was here, right? And he's someone who stood on principle and lost his job, right? He would have lost the election. He decided not to stand for election because there's no chance in the world he would have won if he was anti-Trump. He was succeeded by Martha McSally, right, temporarily, he was succeeded by Kyrsten Sinema in the election. But Martha McSally, the other Republican who was appointed instead, had to take a very Trumpist position, and eventually she lost, and now Arizona has two Democratic senators in that process, right? But he gave a speech shortly thereafter at the Harvard Law School where he says, you can always get another job, but you can't get another soul. The truth is the number of Republicans who have taken that position in elected positions who are currently in office today are 5. You know, I would say Ben Sasse, welcome back, Senator from Nebraska, who kind of said the right things a little bit for the last 4 years, but he voted for impeachment. Mitt Romney has come out with some degree of real courage on that front. There's a Ben Kitzenbrink, a congressman, you know, in the House. There's a few others. I mean, there's probably more than five. But the numbers are really, really small because we still haven't worked our way through that, right? So the question you ask is the key, and I don't know the answer to that. And the answer is, what happens 2 years from now? You have midterm elections. And this, to be honest, if you're an Aussie looking at this, or you're a Japanese or a European looking at it, there is this terrifying fear that the United States went insane for 4 years and they could do it again, right? And so in 2 years from now, we're going to have midterm elections. And traditionally in the United States, midterms are an indictment on or an evaluation of the party. And opposition parties tend to do really good in midterm elections, right? That's just how it generally tends to work, right, in terms of the process. So the Biden administration, I think one of the reasons they moved so quickly to move beyond impeachment and to focus on getting this $1.9 trillion COVID relief package out the door is they have to show results. They need to have the health situation better, the economy better. They've got to have people feeling good because they've only got an 8-seat majority in the House, narrower than it was last time, and the Senate is split evenly 50-50, right? So it's a really touch-and-go game for that. And again, obviously, you know, they can't win back the presidency in 2 years, but they could stymie the Biden agenda if the Republicans take over. And so that's a real race. And I don't think anybody knows the answer to that yet. As I said in my opening remarks, I'm quite optimistic. The early steps suggest they're doing a pretty good job of it, but it's a tough, tough job. The real question is, you know, what does Donald Trump do? You know, one, he's been deprived of Twitter, that's good, but he's speaking today at the CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Committee, I think it is, this big conference. And, you know, if he decides to go full on, you know, revolutionary and to break from the Republican Party and start his own Donald Trump Party, to be honest, that would be great, right? Because that would split the party and they'd have no hope of winning. My overall assessment is I tend to be more optimistic than those who are worried about a pendulum swing back. I tend to believe that demography is destiny. And that what we saw in Donald Trump for 4 years was the last gasp of that sector of the electorate, right? And again, what we saw in Georgia and in Arizona, I'm hoping will be replicated in Texas and in North Carolina and even South Carolina as we build with a younger, more diverse demographic that looks more like America it does today. That demographic swing continues, but it's not a foregone conclusion. You know, that's something that's going to have to be fought for. Sorry, again, I'm doing long answers. So I apologize.
Thank you, Gordon. My name is Heather Rogers. You, like me, the two of us voted for Joe Biden, although you're an independent and I'm a registered Democrat. What do you think about the QAnon uprising and insurrection, and they feel that Donald Trump is going to be elected on March the 4th, which was until 1933 the inauguration day. It was changed in 1933 to January the 20th. The FBI is already at battle stations ready to do this. How much do you think this QAnon movement is going to damage even President Biden's healing process?
There are some rather quirky things about the United States, if you haven't noticed. We have the oldest constitution in the world right now, in terms of a living, functioning constitution, and it is regarded by many as holy writ. But, you know, we've already had 18 amendments. I don't know. I keep looking at Robin. She'll tell me how many amendments we have. How many amendments are there? 20, but anyway, there's a lot of amendments, so it's not a perfect document. But it set out some really strange things that were appropriate back in 1700s rural America. And one of those is that strange gap between the election and the inauguration. And you're right, it used to be even longer, right? A November election, and you wouldn't have a new president inaugurated till the spring so they could get up the muddy roads, you know, to have some type of inauguration originally March 4th. That's been moved till the 20th of January, but still it's a bizarre, long, long period of time where we saw it, you know, idle hands or devil's playground kind of thing. That was just way too much time, you know, beyond between election and transition. So now, having said that, the focus of your question is on something called QAnon, right? So Q is you know, a conspiracy movement. No one knows who Q is, but you know, they had these great prophecies that the 6th of January was going to be the day of thunder, and that was going to be when the people would rise up and take back their government, because they all believed the big lie. And it's also, it's just used a lot of stuff, to be honest, which even in my family and relatives, if you're just a normal person, you're just flipping through social media and you see they're pedophiles. It's this weird thing about, you know, all the Democrats are pedophiles, and they cut up, you know, Hillary Clinton cuts up babies and eats them, and it's just weird, weird stuff, right? It's really weird, but it's just prevalent. It's everywhere out there, particularly in social media. So the decline of the mainstream media, the rise of this hyper-partisan media, even in the first thing, and then social media has enabled this to have legs like you wouldn't believe in terms of the process. Now, in the end, that was one of the things that was directly tied to the insurrection on the 6th of January. You're absolutely correct. There is concern that they will then use the 4th of March as another opportunity, because they still believe the prophecy that Donald Trump will be rightfully installed as president. Their numbers are dwindling. I mean, there's been a lot of surveys to show that there's an awful lot of formerly QAnon believers who were shocked when the prophecy didn't come true, right? When Biden was inaugurated, and that cognitive dissonance woke up a lot of them. There's still some hardcore believers. The difference now is, though, that we have an FBI who is free to do their job, right, without political interference. We've just had Merrick Garland. Is he confirmed? I think Merrick Garland's confirmed. He's having his confirmation hearings as we speak. Merrick Garland, you may recall, was nominated by the Obama administration, by President Obama, to be a Supreme Court justice. He's now been nominated, and I think within hours will be confirmed as the Attorney General. And one of the things he made it very clear was, and the Department of Justice already made clear, is that they regard, as in New Zealand and Australia, far right-wing terrorism to be the most imminent threat to the nation. Right? And so for us, it's so easy for a population just to blame others, right? There's Muslim extremists, right? It's people who don't look like us, people who have different skin colors, it's foreigners. And that's easy to get people worked up on, right? But the truth is, the data has shown for a long time, they're far more concerned about people on the far right with guns in terms of civic disruption, loss of life, acts of terror than on that front. The good news is, in contrast to just, you know, a month and a half ago, instead of being encouraged, aided, and abetted, you know, that will be attacked and suppressed and managed and handled. So I don't believe there will be a second coming on the 4th of March. Donald Trump will not be reinstituted president, and the hardcore true believers will have one more day of cognitive dissonance as they slowly become de-radicalized in that process. That's my hope. That's my optimistic hope.
Ian Porter, I'm afraid I don't share your optimism about America and about Australia's alliance with it. If we look at America historically, we had equality pretty well on a par with Australia, you know, over the last sort of, if we look back 40 years, 50 years. But since the rise of big capital, we've seen a shift, and inequality is pervasive. And so if we add the eye of inequality onto the three that are already on the screen, and then we see how the perversion of information, another eye, through the information media, controlled by people like Rupert Murdoch, of which we've seen lots of publicity on his power. How do you see the future in terms of the alliance of Australia following America into its crazy wars, which are used basically to prop up the big capital of the military-industrial complex?
So you're absolutely correct. A fourth eye could be inequality. You're spot on. It's a real serious issue that has been sapping American strength for a long time. It's difficult for Australians to understand after we've gone through this almost unbroken 30-year period of economic growth, a time during which the average middle-class income went up dramatically. The United States didn't have the same thing. Today, on the floor of the Senate, in debating this relief bill, Senator John Thune from North Dakota gave this great story about how he started working in a burger shop. He got paid $1 an hour, and then by working very hard, he got up to being paid $6 an hour. And somebody did some quick analysis that said if you did just basically, consumer price index adjustment, that would be $25 an hour today, right? So the U.S. minimum wage, which hasn't been changed for nearly 25 years, falls further and further behind. The inequality grows larger and larger and larger. But I think there's a recognition of that now. A part of that is my broader optimism of the demographic shift that's taking place. And so let me put it this way. The U.S. elections were fundamentally stolen and unfair and corrupt and cheating, just not in the way the Trump voters think. It was in the opposite direction, right? There was gerrymandering, there were restrictions on who could vote, how they could vote. There were massive voter suppression efforts that took place over decades and decades to suppress minorities, to suppress immigrants, to suppress women, to make it hard to vote, right? They don't have a holiday to vote, right? They don't have sausage sizzles, right? It's in the middle of November and it's really cold and it's in a work day. And we saw just this last election in Texas, right? To try to do early voting, the governor of Texas said, all right, we're only gonna allow one ballot drop box per county. Harris County, with a lot of minorities and 1.7 million people, you get one. Lubbock County, majority white and a few thousand, you get one, right? The election was fundamentally unfair, and yet Joe Biden won in a historic sweep. 8 million more votes. Arizona turned, right? Georgia turned, right? And so that's the source of my optimism, right? There is this demographic shift taking place. And on the one hand, it's easy to look at America and say, oh, it's horrible, it's all these crazy things. But the reality is, if you look at that organization, what's coming up, you look at Amanda Gorman, who gave the speech. If you look at Stacey Abrams, who organized in Georgia, you can't help but think, oh, I love that country. I love my country, right? Because of that's coming up. And that's the source of my optimism, right? Then you add on to that, there's just a lot of pent-up demand for these things to move. And the U.S. tends to move in fits and starts, right? And we're still wrestling with the original sin, right? But in doing it in a very public way, the original sin being slavery in terms of that process. But, my view is we make progress in terms of that process. So, again, you're spot on. Inequality is a real issue. But my guess is, the near-death experience of the insurrection and of the last 4 years has the potential to have a real positive impact. Now, I could be dead wrong, right? We could, in 2 years from now, slip back into Republican control. But again, demography is destiny, right? I look at the America that my kids grew up in, and it's fundamentally different than the America that voted for Donald Trump. And when I say demography is destiny, we also know something about that voter cohort that voted for Donald Trump, right? Is that they're not immortal. That moves on, and that's shifting. And so, if I look at the state of Texas, if I look at the state of North Carolina and South Carolina, Florida's kind of crazy. Give up on Florida, right? But I think you're going to see some fundamental shifts that will stun and surprise. I remain fundamentally bullish. And in contrast, to be honest, I arrived in Perth 7 years ago, having brought with me from Washington a fundamental skepticism about China. I've been to China 30-odd trips. I've been to 40 cities in China, have hundreds of really close friends in China, would never for a second consider myself a China basher. But I came here far more concerned about Chinese weakness than Chinese strength. Meanwhile, on St. George's Terrace, anybody suggested anything other than 1 billion metric tons of steel consumption a year and China growing for another 30 years at the same rate it had grown for the last 30 ones was considered to be a heretic, right? Now, after the last 4 years of Xi Jinping, or the last 5 years of Xi Jinping, we're in a tough spot in terms of China, its position in the world, their own domestic problems. So I would put it this way. You're spot on about every one of those problems, But I would take every problem that America faces today by orders of magnitude before I would take the fundamental challenges that China faces going forward. And that informs my view of where Australia's interests lie, where the world's interests lie. And again, going back to what I said about the Quad meeting in October, why would India, Japan, and Australia rush to embrace, you know, the Quad at this time? Right? Why? I'm not stupid. Right? There's a fundamental assessment of where again, all problems aside, where the future holds. So I cling to that little bit of optimism. So.
And thank you, God and Samina Yasmin, both from AIIA and UWA. I'm glad you finished where you did, because I'm going to take issue with that, because I think I wouldn't say so much about Australia and Japan, but when it comes to India's assessment, I think we need to acknowledge the fact that India and China last year had the border conflict, and only 3 days ago they decided to withdraw their troops from the line where, of actual control. So I think when India decided to run to the meeting, it's as much to do with the fact that they wanted, maybe, and we can talk about that, hope that somehow Trump would come back again and then they would be able to show that they are really a reliable ally, but also to give a message to China that they are not on their own. Because if that wasn't the case, they wouldn't have agreed to this pull out that they've just, two sides have agreed. So I think we need to watch that with bit more sort of openness and not just say, oh, it's a sign. What I'm really going to, I mean, that's what I was going to comment on, but the question really is that you haven't mentioned one of the most famous Americans of Indian origin, the vice president. And what does that mean for America, not just simply lurching towards normalcy, but actually contributing to what Biden has constantly been saying, example, power of our example as opposed to example of our power, because I think it's a very powerful image. So I was wondering if you could say something about that.
On your observation, I understand exactly what you're saying. I mean, you don't want to over project upon India what India will do, because India will act in India's interest. I am, shall we say, skeptical of any longer-term rapprochement between India and China. Just 2 years ago, we had a very similar issue on Doklam, which was resolved, only to come back in a stronger firm. Just wait. My anticipation is that Xi Jinping's China and the mandate they have in terms of their own domestic politics to continue to push on this front, and again, that nationalist sentiment there that's pushing that means that these issues aren't gone away. I think I don't know anyone in India that thinks that the current decision now to step back is the end of this conflict, right? So it's coming right back. That fundamental contestation will continue. But you're spot on. India will act in India's interest. You can't consider it to be an ally of the United States. It's not, right? It's got this long tradition of non-alignment. But having said that, my goodness, if you told me a decade ago that India would be today where it is today, I wouldn't have believed you, right? So the notion that it's unchanging is also not true. Kamala Harris, you're spot on. The symbolism of her election is in many respects very similar to the symbolism of Barack Obama's election, right? Now look, I was raised in the United States. There's a children's TV show called Sesame Street. I don't know if they ever competed with the Bananas and Pajamas on ABC or something, but I grew up with Sesame Street, right? As a kid, it was produced in New York City. Everybody was diverse. There were black kids and Hispanic kids, and it was a very cosmopolitan thing, right? And if you think of my generation, the sports heroes were Michael Jordan. The pop heroes were Michael Jackson. The most popular TV show was The Cosby Show, which is problematic for another reason altogether right now, right? But, and so for my generation, the idea that America would vote for an African-American president was not strange at all, right? And so I remember all my Japanese and Korean friends at the time said, America will never vote for a black man for president. I'm like, what are you talking about? Of course we will. I, at the inauguration of Barack Obama, was so naive. I did not understand how a large segment of our population would react to it. And here, I'm going to be really blunt, right, on this. There is a horrific joke which helps explain a fundamental problem you have with the major population in America, including relatively inaffluent, you know, poor Americans, right? And that is, what do you call a black doctor? And the answer is the N-word, right? Shocking joke, right? But that tells you something you need to know, that for a long time, you know, and Lyndon Johnson said this. He says, you know, as long as you give someone, no matter how poor they are, someone to look down upon, they will let you rob them blind. He said that when he supported the Civil Rights Act in 1964 and said, we've lost the South for generations, right, to come. He said that. That was his quote, right? You know, so this notion that, you know, you had a core segment of our population that, you know, like it or not, were fundamentally racist, you know, and all of a sudden, for 8 years, they had to see a Harvard-educated, you know, very articulate, brilliant president, and his Ivy League 2-degree educated wife, brilliant, with their beautiful family, on TV every single day. And it was just cognitive dissonance. You couldn't believe it. So he can't be American. He's a Kenyan. He's a socialist. He wasn't born here. All these crazy, we don't believe his birth control, right? You know, his birth certificate, right? All this things coming out in the process, right? You know, and it was just a really hard thing. That was a fundamental problem, and it was born of the divides in our country. I completely misread that, right? You know, from day one, the Republican minority recognizing that it was in their interest to say, our goal is not to advance our policies, not to advance our ideology, but to make sure that Barack Obama is a one-term president, right? And there was support for that, right? And it's that same group that's carried on to the QAnon, gone forward and that stuff, right? But that never represented America. In the last 4 years, not at no point, at any point during his 4 years presidency, did Donald Trump enjoy majority support. Okay? Right now, Joe Biden's approval rating is about 56%. He's 10 points and more above where Donald Trump was for his entire presidency. On handling COVID, he's about 64%. He's got a third of Republicans saying he's doing the good thing, right? And that there's a hard way to explain that any other way than the fundamental difficulty of dealing with race with a certain demographic in the United States, right? So going back to your question, Kamala Harris, you know, was a really powerful symbol. Now that same cohort is, they believe now that Joe Biden is senile, a doddering fool, and he's only in there as a conspiracy, okay, that Kamala Harris is actually just running the show. But that's not what the majority of Americans see. The majority of Americans celebrated seeing, you know, Amanda Gorman give that beautiful inaugural, the poem that made me cry. The majority of Americans, the new America that gives me the optimism, right? Which is more than 50%, right? You know, it's just that we've had a system that has been so skewed by the minority, by the callous and conniving use of laws to perpetuate minority rule. But I think this is my optimism. That enabled them to stretch it out 4 years longer than they should have, but that time has passed. Now, we may have a relapse, but I'm still long-term optimistic that that's the trajectory we're going on. And you're spot on. You know, and it's not just Kamala Harris. So the two Senate nominations, the two cabinet nominations before the Senate that have hit the biggest trouble, you're going to be surprised by this, are Noreen Tanda, who's the nomination for head of the Office of Management and Budget, and Deb Haaland. So one is a Native American woman to be the first ever Secretary of the Interior, and one is another Indian American woman. And all of a sudden, the Republicans are aghast because she said something mean in a tweet. I mean, what are you talking about for the last 4 years? Think if there's one area where the bar would have been slightly lower, but it's not surprising that that's where they're attacking, right? You know, women of color. But again, I think that's passing, right? You know, interesting. It looks like Deb Haaland has gotten through. And the interesting thing is, the president has been remarkably supportive of Noreen Tanda, and I'm hopeful for that. I don't think that's done yet. So we'll see how that plays out. But you're spot on. The remarkable diversity of this cabinet is a cabinet that looks like America. And Donald Trump's cabinet looked like American leading class in 1950. So it's not a surprise that he wanted to make America great again. It was really make America what it looked like in 1950. That's what he wanted, right? And that's not where it is today, and that's where I'm optimistic about. So. Sorry, I've got a...
I feel like we could keep you here all evening, Gordon, but we might just take one last question on the front here.
Gordon, Nigel Rogers. Just shifting back to foreign policy now, the United States and defense policy, and thinking of two specific countries. First, the United Kingdom, which is supposed to have a so-called special relationship with the United States. I don't think President Biden is a fan of Boris Johnson. Secondly, he didn't like the fact that the UK left the EU. And he certainly doesn't like the arrangements in Northern Ireland. He has Irish roots. So this is going to change the dynamics, I think, with between the US, and this might become less special, the relationship. And the second one is North Korea. How is the United States under a Biden government going to handle North Korea? Trump kind of cozied up to what he called Rocket Man. We kind of had a lot of publicity, but nothing ever really happened. What do you see the future on those two fronts?
Yeah, those are both topics that I could spend an entire evening on, but I'll keep it very brief. Look, the U.S.-UK relationship, the special relationship, has not been so special for quite a while, even pre-Trump, right? I mean, the truth is, if you look at level of intimacy, interoperability, intelligence sharing, level of importance, I would argue for a long time that Australia has usurped that role in terms of how it's seen in the United States. You know, so Great Britain has been on a small Britain trajectory for a while, right? Everything you pointed out is exactly right. I would add one positive note on that is that, you know, Boris Johnson is—he's not a man of principles or a particular ideology. He's just kind of an entertainer and a chameleon, and he has found a newfound zeal for working on climate change. And so there will be many opportunities like that for the U.S. and the U.K. to work together. Similarly, the U.K. has now applied for membership in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which again is a welcome development. You know, they've asserted that they are an Indo-Pacific power, which again is a welcome development. But in the end, to be honest, the UK is not what the UK was. Those are relatively minor issues. Of all the issues that Biden administration is dealing with, the UK will not take a lot of his time or thought in terms of that process, right? It's not a priority. North Korea, again, this is an issue I've worked on personally for the better part of 30-odd years. I was simply aghast at what happened in the Trump administration with North Korea. I did my utmost to be open-minded, to think maybe that 30 years of inside-the-box thinking that I had done was wrong, and that maybe it took someone of stunning ignorance and naivete to actually do something different. But in the end, like everything else, it was just a reality TV show. All Trump wanted was just he wanted to have the Singapore summit. The great breaking news this week was leaks now that Trump had invited to give Kim Jong-un a ride back to Pyongyang on Air Force One from Hanoi, right? But it's just silly, no strategy, no plan. But in the end result is this, that Trump inherited 15 years of close and careful international coordination, which included Russia and China and Europe and Australia and the international community to make sure that North Korea's actions with this nuclear program and missile program were held within the bounds of the rules-based order. The Missile Control Technology Agency and the Non-Proliferation Treaty, the International IEA Safeguard, International Atomic Energy Agency Safeguards Agreement, and that if North Korea broke them out, that they would have then a series of six different UN Security Council sanctions resolutions upon which they would be held as a consequence. That coordination in the first few months of the Trump administration actually went quite well. But then we got to Little Rocket Man, fire and fury such as the world has never known, you know. And then Trump saw the North-South Summit, and he said, ooh, I like that. And it's reality TV, it's made for TV, it's great. And so we ended up having the craziness of Singapore. And since then, nothing has done, Nothing has been done. It's been basically, we've suspended all reality on that front because Trump is not willing to do anything on it. And in the meantime, North Korea has continued with the development of its missile program, submarine launch, ballistic missiles, and its nuclear program. And now we're going to have to deal with reality. There's going to be a bit of a snapback, right? I don't think, in the absence of any real indication at all from North Korea that they're serious about negotiating, you're not going to see a jump back to negotiations. Again, it's a world of hurt. And again, Biden's priorities are COVID, 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 not Kim Jong-un. And in the event that North Korea does something provocative, I think what you'll see is a coordinated international reality-based approach. And so the final thing I'll end on is Trump never understood America. Again, he was a 14-year-old boy's man or a 12-year-old boy's man, a version of what a rich man was like, you know, with his gold stuff. And he's basically a 12-year-old boy's version of what a president was like, you know, all the science stuff and everything, the work in terms of the process. And his view of foreign policy was very similar, right? He just liked the pomp and the pageantry, not the work. And he never understood, not just what Samina was saying, that America was not great because of the example of its power, but because of the power of its example. He never said that the U.S.'s greatest strength was not just its military, but its alliances and its partners in the international system of standards and norms that he built and that Trump trashed, right? And so the good news is, to answer your question, is that going back to that, you know, I'm confident that whatever the Biden administration does will be carefully coordinated with allies and partners in the international system, you know, in response to it, and not done alone in a capricious manner. And that's optimistic for the full spectrum of foreign policy challenges. We're back in a reality-based world right now.
I'd like to invite Brendan Augustin to deliver the vote of thanks.
As advertised, Gordon, it was a very rich and colorful and multi-layered discussion, both from your presentation and your responses to the questions. I myself had quite a few questions to ask. I think if I could look at a theme today and the questions around the room, China is going to be a topic that we're going to continue to talk about this year, both in the AIIA-WA context, but also across our media, across anyone who's thinking about the future of this country and the region. The question I had, you don't have to answer it, is, well, yes, we don't want to deal with China in the way that China wants us to deal with it, but what do we do instead? And it's the constrain versus contain. I guess constraint is something that Peter Varghese recently wrote about, but how do you actually put it in practice? Because everyone recognizes that this is almost an existential issue for the region. Anyway, I'll leave you with that thought, and thank you, and thank the audience, and thank our members for participating so vibrantly tonight. It's always great to have you here and listen to your insights and years of experience. We welcome you back anytime as a member of the audience to be on the other side and pose our speakers tough questions as they have posed to you. And otherwise, we welcome you as well to join us at dinner if you can afterwards. I think, Gonya, you're going to talk about that a little bit. And as usual, a small token of our appreciation. And as a group, if we hadn't already at the beginning, sorry, I was a bit late, we also like to welcome you as a fellow Australian today.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Brendan, and thank you again, Professor Flake. So so we'll finish up now, and we're just our event topic next month. We have a specialist in human trafficking coming to speak to us. His name is Chris Douglas, and he worked for the Australian Federal Police for 31 years before becoming a consultant with engagements including to the United Nations. So that will be something to look forward to, and we hope to see you there. And if you're not joining us for dinner, just wishing you a safe journey home, and thank you again to Professor Flake. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.